Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the trucking firm Yellow Corp told workers that it was shutting down. That's according to its union, jeopardizing 30,000 jobs as the historic freight brand faces heavy debt loads and operational woes. This company is the third largest less-than-truckload carrier in the U.S. So that means that it uses a warehouse network to combine several smaller shipments on one truck for short-haul deliveries. It's different from long-haul trucking and the parcel industry, those UPSs of the world, which carries individual, usually smaller packages. Very pleased this afternoon to be joined by Thomas Black, Bloomberg industrial logistics and aerospace reporter. He's been all over this story. We're also joined by Bloomberg anchor and markets correspondent Kriti Gupta, who's also been all over this. It's good to have you both with us. Thomas, I wanted to start with you and just give us kind of the latest, because we're still reading that it's the union that's communicating this, not Yellow.
That's right. Yellow hasn't made it official yet, but all the expectations are they will declare for bankruptcy. There may be some legal issues. They're still shopping around their 3PL business, which is a business that coordinates freight and doesn't have trucks. So I don't know if that's slowing things down, but we haven't heard from the company. But the union knows this is happening because the company has shut down operations and workers are no longer going to work.
Well, bankruptcy doesn't always mean that a company shuts down operations, that a company stops what it's doing. I mean, there are plenty of bankrupt companies that continue to have operations. What's going on with Yellow?
Yeah, in this case, trucking's a little bit different because you can get your product stuck in the system. So when the operations are under stress like this, customers tend to flee. And at some point, they have closed operations. They are no longer picking up freight. So we do know that.
All right, so Kriti, come on in here, because I know that you are following the labor story for several companies right now so closely. Talk to me with Yellow specifically about what the back and forth looked like between the union and the company and what the kind of sticking points were.
Well, we know that the Teamsters union negotiations have really kind of set the tone for labor negotiations across the country when it came to what they demanded from UPS, the major shipper. And this included things like eliminating the two-tier wage system, giving benefits, time off. But of course, pay was at the core of it, especially because a lot of these workers, I mean, they're truck drivers, they're manual laborers. This is a very intensive industry, and they weren't getting paid necessarily by the same rate, depending on how many hours that they worked. UPS has really ended, or the Teamsters, excuse me, negotiation have really ended that dynamic. But Teamsters also represents a lot of workers at, say, Amazon, for example, and Yellow, among others. And the Yellow story is really interesting because they had tried to negotiate an agreement with this, by the way, I should say, what used to be kind of a name brand logistics company, and of course has declined since. But they ultimately, I think what you need to know here is, had negotiated a $50 million increase of a payment from Yellow to their employees, and their Yellow's company finances got so bad, they weren't even able to make that payment. Ultimately, Teamster said, look, we're going to strike. And even that didn't pan out simply because there's no money to go around.
Well, the company also really kind of put the blame on the union, saying that the union efforts hurt a plan to combine its trucking divisions for Yellow. What is Yellow's standing on that, and how does that play into the overall picture that we're seeing in the infighting between unions and these companies?
Yeah, well, I think it really speaks to kind of the pattern that I think Yellow has developed. And I mean, Thomas can speak, I think, probably better to this, but essentially this idea that a lot of their financial troubles have come simply from trying to acquire other pieces of the logistics space. And in doing that, that kind of consolidation, which again is very normal when you're trying to gain market share, mm-hmm. has ultimately led to these major debt issues. Add on the higher wages of workers, and specifically what the Teamsters are adding for, and that is an additional cost. So you are seeing this kind of double-barreled whammy, if I will, on kind of how they're able to deal with these.
I'll allow that, Critty. I'll allow that. Thomas, I want to bring you back in here and talk a little bit about the other companies that might be the beneficiaries of Yellow shutting down. XPO Logistics, Old Dominion, for example. From the perspective of customers, is that where they fled?
Yeah, the LTL market is a little bit more concentrated, a lot more concentrated than the truckload market. So there are a handful of large players. FedEx, for example, has an LTL business. There's another company called Sy, and the ones that you mentioned. Those are really the dominant players in this market. There's some smaller ones, but it's concentrated. So those companies have had a decline in their volumes just coming down from the pandemic highs. So they have excess capacity, and they are absorb up, you know, the freight that will come to them. They probably will try to cherry pick it a little bit to make sure they get the most profitable part of that, or the freight that matches up with the lanes that they tend to run. So we're going to see that being divvied up. I would say on the union talks, the company actually came to the union to ask them to reopen the negotiation. Their contract had run through into next year, but they wanted to do this consolidation of their different units to gain some efficiency. So they reopened that contract, and the negotiations didn't go anywhere. And that $50 million payment was a payment that they owed for the pension. And when they couldn't make that, that's when the team decided to pull the plug on their negotiations. Now, whether it's the fault of the Teamsters or not, that's I don't want to make that call. Certainly the company says that's the case. I would just say that the Teamsters, besides the UPS contract, did negotiate contracts with ArcBest freight unit called ABF Freight, which is also an LTL carrier. And they just, they're about to ratify an agreement with T-Force, which is the LTL carrier that UPS sold a couple of years ago. So it's not like the Teamsters aren't doing agreements. This one, I think, was maybe an outlier.
Okay, that's good to know, Thomas. Creedy, I want to bring you back in here because you and I were chatting about this a little earlier about, you know, what you thought sort of were the most interesting element of this story is. And it's one that struck me as well. It's the fact that pretty much everyone listening, if they're a U.S. taxpayer, they're owners of this stock. Taxpayers own 30% of this.
They are. The irony is that the stock is a penny stock now. It doesn't even really hold that much value.
So the taxpayers should have shorted it, is what you're saying.
I mean, I do not give investment advice.
Thank you.
I think that's my favorite fun fact time about this whole story is that, look, because of these big financial troubles that Yellow has gotten into, well, they end up procuring about a $700 million loan in 2020, when a lot of businesses were getting that kind of COVID relief, the idea that under the Trump administration, he used these national security measures to make sure that supply chains were working, that everything was kind of trying to function as best as it could, just given the dynamic there. Under that, Yellow had gotten a $700 million loan that they still have not paid back. So they basically owe the Treasury Department $700 million, and in doing that, by extension, taxpayers own about 30% of the stock. I think, though, one of my favorite kind of things to put into perspective here is simply that when you look at their long-term debt, that $700 million loan represents nearly half of it.
Wow.
It's a lot. So, again, when I say that they're in some serious financial trouble, taxpayers are paying part of it.
All right, final 30 seconds here, Thomas. Is part of the takeaway from this story about overall freight demand declines post-COVID?
I would just say Yellow is an outlier. They've had financial problems really since the Great Recession back in 2008, 2009. So they have been battling financial difficulties for a long time. So I wouldn't read too much into their particular problems for the freight market. Freight market is depressed a little bit, but the strong carriers are going to be able to power through.
Really good stuff, guys. Both of you, really appreciate that. That's Kriti Gupta, Bloomberg anchor and markets correspondent. And the voice you just heard there, Thomas Black, Bloomberg industrial logistics and aerospace reporter. Both of them have been all over this story, so we really appreciate it.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Maddie, I got a true story for you. Last week...
Let's hear it.
Last week, I come into work, and I'm soaking with sweat. And my colleague, Alex Gittleson, says, Tim, how was your bike ride in this morning?
I know. Oh,
and I was like,
embarrassing.
Alex, I took the subway in.
Yeah.
This is how much I sweat when I walk from the subway to our office.
I'm so
two
sorry.
Blocks. And he was like, oh, I'm sorry. You're so sweaty. I thought you rode your bike all the way from Brooklyn. No, that's just because this month has been really hot. Yeah. All that to say, June was hot. In fact, it was the hottest June in recorded history. And this month is the hottest ever July.
Ugh.
It's not good news.
No.
But... it's good that we have Eric Rosten all over this story. It's a big take from last week. An overheating planet requires supercharged climate solutions. Eric joins us on Zoom from our Washington, D.C. bureau. Eric, good to have you with us. First, give us the bad news. Just how bad was July?
July was bad. You have characterized it well. It was the hottest month in recorded history. The temperature records go back to the middle of the 19th century. This year is likely to be the hottest year on record. The last 9 years have been the hottest year on record. The hottest 22 of the hottest 23 years have occurred this century, and every decade has been hotter than the last since the 1960s.
Yeah, so not great. How much more of this are we going to experience throughout the rest of this year? How much more heat can we anticipate? Is this going to happen through the end of 2023 even?
Well, we're helped out in some ways by the fact that July is the hottest month. And so as we spin around the sun toward fall and winter, temperatures will retreat from the peaks we've seen. Yeah. On the other hand, we're also entering hurricane and wildfire season. What's making this year unduly punishing is the coincidence of not only climate change, which just steps up all the time, but also in El Nino, which is this phenomenon of the Pacific Ocean sort of coughs up lots of heat every few years and it makes temperatures hotter and throws weather into chaos in different parts of the world.
It's pretty depressing, I got to tell you, Eric. You know, we get a note from my kids' nursery school that says AQI is over 100 today, so we're not going to let the kids play outside. Meaning the air quality index from the wildfires in Canada a few months ago, and a few weeks ago, actually happened twice recently, prevented the kids from being able to play outside. But it's so hot that you got to be blasting the air conditioner. Where does the electricity come from to blast the air conditioner? Well, because it's not coming from nuclear anymore here in New York. It's coming from fossil fuels. It's creating this terrible cycle that we're in right now, which is, you know, really my question is about solutions, because staying inside and blasting the AC is not a viable solution. That's not going to keep sea levels from rising. That's not going to keep wildfires from happening. That's not going to keep the air clean. What do we do?
We need to get off fossil fuels, even though it's not said that bluntly in American political culture. Fossil fuel burning causes climate change. And until we get that under control, climate change will always be in its opening act. This will be a cold summer in 20 or 30 years. And that's ultimately this whole story. You know, this is not a complicated topic. We've known for many decades that this is occurring. Scientists, you know, warned us for decades that you want to get on top of this before the symptoms start occurring. Mm-hmm. The symptoms are occurring. Fortunately, and this is the good news, we have the tools, right? We have affordable solar, wind, and battery technology. Solar is cheaper than coal in most of the world on a levelized cost basis. We have wild investment into things that are not solved technologically yet. This story, the reason this is the greatest story ever, is that the stakes could not be higher. But, you know, we have the fixes, and all we need to do is the work to implement them. Like, that's it. All we have to do is the work.
Can we reverse some of the damage that's already been done? Or when you said this is going to be viewed as a cool summer in 20 or 30 years, is that a foregone conclusion, or can we fix it still?
The scientists have said, in a break from previous years, they think that as soon as we stop increasing the atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases, that the warming will stop pretty quickly thereafter. That's what passes for good news in this space. But you know, it's a situation, right? This is not it's not great news. We've known about it for a long time. We've put it off for a long time, and that's just where we are. I as someone who covers this, you know, we get climate reporters, I think, get this question a lot, which is, how do you deal with it? And part of the part of it is by being in touch with everything that's going on. There's a way that kind of diffuses anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you can understand something, it makes it less scary. But the other thing is that, like, again, like, I cannot overemphasize the excitement around clean energy technologies. The rate of growth, the rate of the price declines, it's just phenomenal how quickly we can solve the problem if we decide to.
Nancy Lyons in our DC newsroom, who I believe is probably, Eric, just a few steps from you, because I think you're in the same newsroom today. She just sent in our chat a great question and reminded me that the problem when it comes to renewables is consistent power supply. You know, when there is no wind, when there is no sun, when it's nighttime, how do we get to a place where we can actually store power that's generated in the day to offset fossil fuel use at night? Or is the answer just nuclear?
Both of the answer. The price declines in utility scale batteries have plummeted, like the curve, just like somebody looks like somebody just like dropped an egg on the chart of price declines, right? It's just like very precipitous. So increasingly you see utility scale batteries, and nuclear is an option that has been there the whole time. And it is a critical source of baseline electricity. It's just people just seem not to be able to build them. They're just, they come in billions of dollars over budget and many years late. You know, when you look at the time crunch we're in to have global emissions by 2030, like, you can't build nuclear in that time, or at least nobody has. So, you know, nuclear is, you know, it's this tragedy of like having a carbon-free source of power that, you know, we've used for more than half a century, but nobody will build them.
Yeah. In our final minute with you here, I'm curious about legislation around this because you are in DC for us. How effective has legislation like the Inflation Reduction Act been at sort of solving some of the issues that you're talking with us about?
It's the most phenomenally important climate legislation that any country has ever passed. You know, the International Energy Agency says we need to triple renewable deployment by 2030. We need to double energy efficiency, and the oil and gas sector needs to cut its methane emissions by 75%. There are things in the Inflation Reduction Act and now in copycat legislation in Europe that will incentivize all of those things. So it's difficult to overstate the importance of how much that legislation will help things along. There's still more that's needed. One interesting thing is, like, we're going to build so much solar and wind in the U.S. that, like, we can't keep up with plugging it into the grid fast enough. And so it's interesting, like, the federal government can, you know, can build pipelines and highways, but they can't build transmission.
Right.
So that's something Congress has to fix.
Eric, we got to run, but we love it when you join us. Thanks so much for doing this. That's Eric Rostin, sustainability editor at Bloomberg News.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I've been talking a lot about investors, and they've been very bullish this year on everything from AI to big tech, chip manufacturing, of course, Tim. But, you know, one other thing that they're bullish on, it turns out, is women's soccer.
Yeah, we got a great story featured in Business Week newsletter recently, the BW Daily newsletter. And with the World Cup going, we're going to get a pulse check on women's soccer specifically, Maddie.
Yeah, we're thrilled to have Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber here with us in studio, as well as reporter Ira Boudoué to discuss. And as always, you can find this story on Bloomberg.com and on the terminal. But Joel, talk to us, because investors, they're into a lot of sports right now.
They are.
Pickleball.
Pickleball, right? Being
yes.
one.
That's it.
But pickleball. The thing with pickleball is that it's really loud.
It's so loud.
It's so loud. And it's like, maybe you've heard it.
So that's not going to, like,
heard about
pop,
it and
be
you've
investor
literally
friendly.
Heard it. Yeah. Pop, pop, pop.
Nice.
Still love it. Still love it. But, you know, look, it's World Cup season, and it is a huge reminder of just whenever this comes around, every 4 years, all eyes just go to it. And America's obviously really good at the American team is really good. So good. Right. And kind of a lukewarm start here. We'll see what happens. But reminded how much people love watching it. Right, Ira? And so far. And I'm curious what the business really looks like. And it's just this reminder of, like, when this comes around, it's like, it pulls everybody in, and it turns out this business just gets better and better and better.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, this is the third time that the National Women's Soccer League, it's the third time that the U.S. has tried a professional women's soccer league, and each time it's sort of been tied to the buzz and hype of the World Cup. So in, you know, after the 99ers, the famous team in 1999 that won it here on U.S. soil, huge sensation, Mia Hamm, all of that proved that they could draw huge crowds. They launch a league, and after three seasons, $100 million spent, it collapses. And I think some people thought that meant there wasn't a market beyond the national team. But if you talk to people in this world now, they say the lesson of that was basically that you need more patience and time. If you look at any sports league, it takes decades to grow. And what you're seeing now in the National Women's Soccer League is big money coming in, smart investors. You know, we look at Sixth Street just paid, the private equity firm just paid $53 million for the expansion franchise in San Francisco, Bay FC. That shatters the previous, you know, you used to pay $2 million for that kind of thing. And they see this as a real opportunity. They think they're going to reach parity with men's soccer in this country within about a decade. And they're investing $125 million as a commitment. And that those kinds of numbers are what it's going to take. And it's going to take time. But now it looks like the wherewithal is there finally.
What's changed?
Well, if you talk to Alan Waxman at Sixth Street, he says that, you know, one big thing that's changed is just the there are fewer gatekeepers, so you can get yourself in front of fans on streaming networks more easily, right? So they have the NWSL has a deal with CBS that includes every single one of their matches, the ones that aren't on CBS broadcast or sport or cable channel. Are also on Paramount Plus.
Yeah.
So if you're a fan, you can see it.
And yeah, you can find it. Right. That maybe other sports still haven't.
In the past, you had to take whichever little windows you could get from, you know, the gatekeepers. And so that's one. And two, he said.
I hate those gatekeepers.
Yeah.
They're like with the rabbit ear. Joel's like on Sundays with the rabbit ears trying to actually watch a football game.
ESPN. We're showing pickleball on ESPN. And the other thing that's changed in his mind is social media has made the players accessible on a day-to-day basis, and they are the best promotion that you have. So you not only see them every 4 years or maybe at the Olympics, you see them day-to-day, and that's a way to build loyalty and build a customer base.
So in the past, the past two times when this has not worked, when it's failed, it wasn't the social media era. It wasn't the streaming era. Is that enough, though, to make this time a success?
I think if you add that third element of investor patience, right?
Right.
I think that you have to recognize, I mean, you talk to this economist, David Barry, out in Utah, who studied these things. And if you just look at, like, where was the NBA at year 12? That's how old the NWSL is right now. They're in their 11th season. Where was the NFL? Where Major League Baseball teams, you know, the National League, 14 out of the first 16 teams failed. You know, the Pittsburgh Steelers lost money for decades. Like, you really have to, in sports, it's a long-term growth proposition. But once you, because you're building basically generational emotional attachments. And then once you get there, it's almost impossible not to make money because people will come and watch whether you're good or bad. Day in and day out, they will think about you, whether you're doing well or not. But that takes 20, 30, 40 years to create.
Does Messi help? I'm just thinking, you know, that goal was sensational. I watched it like 5 times. And between that and the fact that we've got the World Cup happening right now, you just have to kind of think that all of this could parlay into a moment.
Well, I mean, the joke is that soccer's been the sport of the future in the U.S. since 1972.
But,
yes.
When Messi walks out the pitch, it's a little
That's
different.
True. And to that point, on the women's side, they have an issue because the European leagues, the Super League in the U.K. and some of these teams in Spain and elsewhere that have connections to their men's side, so Barcelona, Chelsea, these clubs, they're now starting to really invest in women's soccer. And they already have emotional attachments through the men's sides with a lot of fans, and they're in some cases paying more than the National Women's Soccer League for talent. And that's going to be a challenge because you have to have whoever the equivalent to Messi is and you have to be able to say we are the best league in the world. And they're going to have to compete. Sam Kerr left for Chelsea. She's the Australian player. She's the highest paid player in the world. She does not play in the National Women's Soccer League. So as they grow, they're not only going to have to invest in all the things that you have to do, stadiums, and so on, but they're going to have to compete for talent.
When you say highest paid player in the world, we're not talking millions of dollars a year.
No.
We're talking less than $500,000 a year. That was shocking for me to see.
Yeah, I mean, she is reportedly the highest paid player in women's football, and she makes about $450,000 a year.
Which, don't get me wrong, that's really good money,
right?
But that's not...
Right.
Men's soccer money.
No, I mean, on top of that, people like Alex Morgan have real opportunities, obviously, in the sort of commercial space, but it's still a huge disparity. And that is another thing that comes with maturity, right? Because really, when you've hit it big is when you're making streaming money or media rights money in the billions. And that's when you then probably have a collective bargaining agreement that says players get half of that, and then the contracts get huge. But before that, it's more difficult to generate those kinds of salaries.
It makes me think about what the audience looks like too, because the reason that I have been drawn to women's soccer is because of the activism surrounding it, and I'm sure that that is not the case for the majority of fans, but that's what got me into it. How much of that are you seeing? People who are in it for the these women getting paid more eventually someday viewership?
I mean, it's, you know, if you go, I go to Gotham FC matches out in New Jersey, and there's definitely a, like the signs in the crowd, a lot of them are about social justice, about believing women, these kinds of things, about pay. So there's an element of that is what I think some of the core fans are there for. And it's definitely a piece of the attraction for this, that idea that it's about time that we started supporting and following women's sports on a par with men's. I think for the league to grow, it has to break out of that. And that's what you're starting to see now, where it's just an entertainment proposition. These are fast, exciting, quality, talented players and competitive, intense matches that you're going to want to see the outcome. You're going to care who wins. And that's when you get to, I think, a stronger investment proposition.
How much is riding on the performance of the women's team, the American women's team, in the World Cup right now? Because, I mean, like I mentioned, there was this tie.
Right.
And like,
well, tonight, yeah, Portugal morning.
No pressure.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, it's tomorrow.
3 a.m.
So, you know, for real, like a lot is riding on this, right? Mm-hmm. Like if somehow America doesn't do that well, like what does that do for this, you know, interest in the sport here?
They have, so the NWSL has 22 of the 23 players on the U.S. team. Yeah. So I spoke with the commissioner, Jessica Berman.
Who's the one that's not?
she plays in France for Lyon, Oran. But I spoke with Jessica Berman. She said, as an American, I'm rooting for the U.S. team, and reminded me that they have 61 players total across all the rosters, around half the teams. Yeah. So they have a stake in a lot of these clubs, but it's clear that I think they would love to see a fifth World Cup victory and these players to come back to their teams, which are playing right now, have them come back in the late summer, fall, and be returning heroes and juice the short term, certainly, you know. Yeah. But in the meantime, they are put together a marketing team to advertise and promote around the World Cup to say, hey, if you love watching these players on this stage, come and watch them on our stage when they get back.
Right. Or now. Since right. It's like all the best players are going to like disappear for a little while.
No, I mean, I have not gone to a Gotham match during the World Cup because, you know, the best players aren't there. Yeah. So it's a short-term loss for them.
Ira, the marketers, the Nikes of the world, the huge consumer packaged goods companies that want to be associated with something really cool, are they stepping up?
They have been, and it's been interesting because you look at Budweiser, or now it's Bud Light. Nike is a big one. MasterCard, I believe. Those deals, they've been investing in the league even as it was going through this scandal and the Sally Yates report and really a lot of questions about player treatment, harassment, abuse. And they stuck with them through that and have, I think, because the league showed that it wanted to, you know, clean house, but that side of the sort of investment, you know, the media side is small, the ownership side is getting bigger fast, but I think the sponsorship side has maybe been the strongest over the last few years, because partly what you were describing of just there's a glow around these teams. It's not just that they're great athletes and it's a great sport to watch, but these people are sort of social heroes as well.
Okay, so I'm curious, like if all these players have this World Cup, they go back to their regular teams, who am I supposed to watch? Like you're making a pitch for a jersey here, but like you know, like how there's obviously there are very fan-centric places like the Portland team, Thorns is viewed as like an example of what this can really look like. Is that true everywhere though? I mean, there's these pockets, right?
Right.
And like you have, and you know, this is big money heading towards San Francisco. So what's the whole league like when there's like really, really strong followings and then, you know, I don't know what Louisville's like.
Right. No, this is something they need to get right, because there's huge, you know, Angel City FC came out with a huge amount of attendance and buzz. The Portland Thorns, you mentioned, reigning champs, they have Sophia Smith, the MVP. They have a really strong following. Bay FC, the new team coming next year, looks like set to really explode. Kansas City's doing great. But it's not across the whole league for sure. And they're looking to expand to 16 teams mm-hmm. within the next few years. And what they're going to need is that kind of enthusiasm league-wide. And that's going to mean not just building that fan base, but having the type of ownership that wants to spend the money that that takes.
And stars too, right? Like the stars can kind of cut through everything. So mm-hmm. who are people on the women's team right now? Who's viewed? We know who the regulars are, but like if somebody's going to rise up and really kind of prove themselves, who are some of those candidates?
Well, I mean, you look at Alyssa Thompson, 18 years old at Angel City FC. I think that's a person that many people expect, along with Sophia Smith, to be the face of the women's game once the sort of current generation, Alex Morgan, Megan Rapinoe of Stars, is retired.
18, yes. It's like,
yeah. And they have, that's another thing that they've developed lately is they've got 15-year-olds. A 15-year-old scored the other night, set the record for youngest player to score in the league because they've set up a mechanism for high school players to be able to play. And they're seeing young athletes skip the chance to go to Stanford or North Carolina to play in the league, which tells you that they believe that this league can really be a platform for the future.
So when a high school student plays, do they get paid? And then if they get paid, they can't go to college?
That's right. They're opting to do this instead of going to college.
What a decision to make at 15.
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, they're still in high school, so they might, you know, things can change. But I think they look at it as you can still go to college later.
You're still allowed, but are you allowed to play in college? Sorry, if you accept, has that rule changed?
That's a good question. I think you can go back. I don't know if your eligibility that's a great question. As a Division I player would be totally expired if you went pro in NWSL. I don't think we've never, that's uncharted.
Joel. But, yeah, we'll find out.
Yeah. Good story.
I will check
that one. I give them out for free, okay?
Yeah. You can certainly go back to school, though, if you want to get an education.
No one's going to prevent you from playing. Right.
Yeah. All right, guys.
And hey, NIL.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us, both of you. Joel Weber, of course, our editor here, and Ira Boudouet.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive. You drive
me crazy. It's the question that drives us. You drive me
crazy. This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Just realized is, Tim, you were on pat leave during the massive AI rally, so you got to miss saying AI 20,000 times.
You know what's great?
Broadcast.
I get to keep saying it.
Yes,
because
that's great.
This AI rally continues.
That is so true. Call it AI euphoria, the FOMO rally, a classic bull market, whatever you want to call it. The market has obviously been on a tear, driven by that exact AI rally. It's set for its longest streak of monthly gains since August 2021 for the S&P. So, as always, with too much of a good thing, you got to wonder, when are we going to start to see the cracks? And that's exactly what I want to ask our next guest. We've got Vivian Hairston, Director of Portfolio Management at Huntington Private Bank, joining us on Zoom. Vivian, thank you so much for being with us. We're seeing that stock exposure for traders at record highs, and the rally really driven by that Magnificent Seven, big tech names. Is there kind of a scary catalyst looming out there that you are anticipating and that could start to kind of turn this market?
Well, thank you for having me. I won't say that there's a scary catalyst. We are cautiously optimistic regarding markets. Really looking at the consumer remains strong. And so markets and the economy both, we're cautiously optimistic. Of course, the Fed did raise rates just by 25 basis points, no surprise, last week. But we, in looking out next 6 to 12 months, we're saying perhaps now that there's maybe a 55% chance that we'll see a recession. But overall on markets, again, as you just mentioned, you know, looking at equity markets, they've been very strong.
They really have.
Well,
I want to go back to the 55% chance that there's going to be a recession. Is that Huntington Private Bank's view?
It is.
Did that change last week after you heard Fed Chair Jay Powell say that even the own internal economists at the Fed are no longer seeing a recession as their base case?
Actually, we became a little bit more cautious before the meeting. And it was, you know, looking at the markets and really after that June meeting, of course, Chair Powell was very hawkish. And so last week, of course, dialed it back a little bit, not as pessimistic, it seems, but we reduced our equity weightings a little bit before the Fed meeting, just looking at where equity, domestic equity markets had been. I really just thought it was best, you know, to lock in some of those gains.
When you think about the recession call, I wonder to what extent you feel like company earnings are part of that calculation. Are you looking at earnings that we're going to get this week from the likes of Amazon and Apple when sussing out the strength of our economy?
Well, we did consider the fact that earnings in the first quarter came in better than expected. Of course, those earnings were better than expected on lowered expectations. And what we're hearing now is we're beginning to hear some earnings revisions coming down again, forward earnings coming down again. And so we are kind of, again, just being cautious. We've seen so far, I think the expectation coming into the quarter was down about 9%. And what we're seeing, I think, is somewhere about 9.2. And so that does provide us caution.
And I noticed that you trimmed your equities holdings by 10% and added to fixed income, which I'm so curious about. It feels like you're really getting paid to go into fixed income right now. How much are you changing your thinking on allocation between stocks and bonds there?
So we actually trimmed by 5% our equity holdings. And then we took that 5, and you are correct, and we added it to fixed income for a number of reasons. Of course, you know, fixed income is finally attractive after 20 some years. And so now you're seeing those yields on fixed income and cash above the, you know, inflation. And so that third leg of the stool is available to investors. And we just thought, looking at domestic equities, again, looking at those returns, some of those returns we'd be happy to have had just for a year, let alone, you know, 6-7 months into a year. And so we thought it was prudent just to take some of those gains off the table.
So it raises the question about somebody who comes to you right now with, you know, a few million dollars. Let's say they had an exit. They want you to deploy the money for them. They have a time horizon of, they've got a long time horizon. This is money for later. Are you comfortable putting money in equities right now?
We are. And, you know, really not just right now, when, if we kind of take a look back, that 5% yield on cash is very attractive, and one might be tempted to perhaps hold the money in cash. But really, as you mentioned earlier, the returns that we've seen in equities, they've been relatively narrow. Of course, we've seen that leadership in those seven tech consumer or communication services companies. So now what we're beginning to see is really that performance begin to broaden out, whereas communication services, information technology is still leading year to date, what we're beginning to see is a little bit of broadening. Mm-hmm. You know, if you use energy as an example, up about 7% so far this month.
Sure. And in our final kind of 45 seconds with you here, I want to talk about some of the stocks you've recently added. And in our note here, we have Adobe, American Express, T-Mobile, and Netflix in that list. Talk to me about your thinking on Netflix, because the earnings picture was not great, particularly in the market reaction.
Well, really, you know, again, just thinking about the consumer, and my area of expertise isn't the individual companies. We have a wonderful research team that could probably talk a little bit and go a little bit deeper. But again, looking at consumer trends, of course, Netflix earlier changed their model a little bit in terms of how they were going to be charging clients or feeing clients out. Not sharing those passwords and like. And so we anticipate that they will begin to see a turn and some better earnings.
Vivian, we're going to have to leave it there. We really appreciate you taking the time this afternoon. Vivian Hairston is a director of portfolio management at Huntington Private Bank. She joins us via Zoom this afternoon.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.